within these pocket forests, we can create urban acupuncture, meaning small spaces can immediately become wild, lush places of habitat. So if you create all these kind of touch points within a city, you can actually really help that biodiversity come back.
Welcome to Meet the Leader, a podcast where top leaders share how they're tackling the world's toughest challenges. In today's special episode, ahead of Earth Day, we talk to Elise Van Middelem all about the incredible concept of pocket forests, her startup Sugi, and how nature can transform cities, lives, and mindsets. Subscribe to Meet the Leader on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. I'm Linda Lucina from the World Economic Forum, and this is Meet the Leader.
The most surprising effect, and actually a beautiful effect, is people, is that these pocket forest bring community together. My hope is that we can reconnect as many people as possible to nature.
Around 2.5 billion more people will live in cities by 2050. That's according to the UN. And in other words, 2 out of every 3 people on Earth will live in cities in just a few decades. That has huge implications, as you can imagine, to everything from habitat loss to pollution to human health. One unique solution can help with all that: pocket forests. In 2019, Elise Van Middelem founded Sugi. That is a global organization that conceives, plans, and funds pocket forests all over the world. 242 cities on 6 continents so far, all using the proven Miyawaki method of planting dense, biodiverse forests and leveraging native species. She likens these pocket forests to a type of urban acupuncture, one that can protect biodiversity, restore ecosystems, and reconnect people to nature. I had a chance to talk to her at the Urban Transformation Summit last fall in Detroit, and she shared with me the amazing changes that can come when bringing these forests to cities, including the return of things that we might take for granted, things like birdsong and the rustling of leaves. She'll talk about this and how this experience has changed her as a leader. She'll also share how anyone can reconnect with nature and why making that a priority is so important. We will get into all of that, but first, she'll get us started with more on Sugi, what inspired it, and how it began.
Sugi, it's the name of a tree, is my favorite tree. It's the Cryptomerica japonica, the sister of the redwood. And in fact, in Japan, there are over 2,000-year-old Sugi trees, and they're called the Yomon Sugi. And they're like nurturing mothers. On top of them grow 13 different woody species. And so it's that idea of like the kind of ideals we'd love to embrace within Sugi is that interconnectedness, that kind of cohabitation, and that also diversity of species, they can thrive together.
Tell us a little bit about Sugi for those who aren't familiar. What does it do and what is the impact it's driving?
Sugi is a global organization, and our goal is, and it's threefold. It's biodiversity, it's ecosystem restoration, and reconnecting people to nature. And we do that through the creation of ultra-dense, biodiverse pocket forest of native species only. It's a method that we adopt. It's a Japanese method where we plant on minimal space, maximum diversity.
How did you get the idea to do this? Like, tell us a little bit about what your inspiration was and why you needed to execute it in the way that you do.
So first of all, a Sugi is born out of a personal need. I wanted to plant trees, but I had a hard time understanding, you know, the accessibility, the visibility, the accountability, you know, how and where are these trees planted? And so the idea really was to bring nature closer, to plant right where we live and work. And through the creation of these pocket forests and cities, you touch upon a myriad of solutions. And first, at a human health, you know, it's that nature deficit order, it's joy, it's cleaner air, it's cooler air, reduction of temperatures. But then there's also that whole biodiversity ecosystem level. And that is, of course, you know, the biodiversity, the birdsong, you know, through that creation of dense pocket forest, we have migratory birds that come back. It's soil health, it's the web of life. All that comes together.
Tell us a little bit more about urban forests and how you sort of solve for that in cities around the world.
First of all, and I think it's important, urban forests. So there's different ways to plant trees, right? There's trees in streets, there's parks. But when we talk about urban forests, we talk about pocket forests. And again, we talk about that density. We talk about on 1 square meter, 10 square feet, we plant 3 trees. Pocket forest for us is that idea of like urban acupuncture. So today our cities, nature is an integral part of it. It is not some sort of like, oh yeah, add on. We all need that nature, and the services they provide, they can really be translated within these pocket forests. We can create urban acupuncture, meaning small spaces can immediately become wild, lush places of habitat. Is it for pollinators? A bee can travel 1.3 miles. So if you create all these kind of touch points within a city, you can actually really help that biodiversity come back.
And how do you do this? Maybe take us through maybe one particular project that you've done, how you've sort of helped create and enable a pocket forest.
Yeah, so today we've created, until this day, 170 pocket forests around the world. The method in itself is very simple. It's that you look at a space and you start with the soil. So this is very important. We never plant a single tree. We always look at it as a whole. And I think that's the most important part of a pocket forest, is that you look at it as a biome. So it becomes this kind of one self-sustaining whole. And you start with the soil, you bring back the natural ingredients through manure, through mycelium networks and compost. You plant densely and then you mulch heavily. Through the mulching, you actually create its own ecosystem. And then through that dense plantation, which is fantastic, you create that underground collaboration and above the ground sort of mini competition for light. So within 2 to 3 years, we have self-sustaining forest.
What is the change then for biodiversity for cities where there's a pocket forest? What's the change?
Yeah, so we see it already today happening. So spaces as from like 1,000 square feet, 2,000 square feet, we really see from one street to the other where there is birdsong, where there is all of a sudden sound, there's a rustling of leaves, there's a vibration, there's species that come back. So in many cities where we planted endangered species, because we plant native, and where can they find habitat still? Where can a bird nest uninterrupted? It's very hard. There's a lot of noise and sound in the city, but through the creation of that ultra-dense biome and that one ecosystem, you allow for a bird to nest. You know, in Pakistan, we had a National Geographic photographer go into the forest and find endangered species that had not been seen before. Same in with the Yakama Nation in the U.S. It's that idea of bringing back that was once there.
Has there been a particular city that maybe its transformation was surprising even to you?
The most surprising effect, and actually a beautiful effect, is people, is that these pocket forests bring community together. They're planted, and we always say the more the merrier, they're planted with a lot of joy and a lot of laughter, but for children in particular. You see, we plant a lot in schools. We call them the outdoor classrooms. If you think of it today, our schools, you know, there's a lot of concrete up on concrete. So we depave and we rewild. And for children, they become the places where they learn, but where they also can sit on very hot days. And for kids to touch soil, you'd be surprised. Most of them have never done it. Most of them have never like touched a worm, because we put worms back in the soil. They aerate and they bring life. And so I think one of the biggest effects that we see today is it, you know, in a neighborhood, is it in a school, is that how people become stewards of the forest and take ownership. And the best and thriving forest is planted within a community. For example, in the Yakama Nation, we created a healing forest with a correctional facility. And imagine the land was dust, nothing, no life, nothing. We planted with the inmates, and today this is a thriving forest. And I think Native American culture, they were the original stewards of the land. And for them to create that realignment and create like an access to the silent nation, the plant nation, is quite powerful, because today they are making teas and they're making educational workshops within the forest. So it has been a reintroduction of what was once there. In Cameroon, with Limbe, for example, imagine water catchments, right? They are the essential part of a community. They wash their clothes there, they get drinking water, they wash their bikes, wash their cars. But the encroachment on the water catchments was on to that level that there was almost no more water running. So today what we've doing actually really actively, we've done five now, is rewilding the water catchments. And the stories are so powerful because 1,000 square meters is about 10,000 square feet, 3,000 trees. The water runways became so strong that they now put solar panels and are pumping the water to other villages. So, you know, small spaces, massive impact. Some things that we also can't measure in the sense that, you know, we plant and then the rest is up to the community. But then also like in London, if you think about it, there's different kinds of councils. And they were working with two councils in Barking, Dagenham and in Newham. And we're looking at that kind of really low income neighborhood that they have huge problems with flooding and heat islands. And so what we're doing is creating these pockets of diversity within schools and in their parks. Because parks today, when it's a hot summer like we had a year ago, with no rain, they become just like concrete and just scorching hot. So what we're doing is that we're transforming these parks and really being in that kind of forest within it, dense forest.
In 10 years, what impact do you hope Tsugi will have had? Like what's the before and after you would hope to see in 10 years?
First of all, these forests are in 2 to 3 years self-sustaining, and Tsugi today is 4 years, and we can already see massive transformation. By the end of the year, we'll have 200 pocket forests planted. And you literally can already see the transformation. And my hope was, I mean, we had to start somewhere. And we started really with dots around the world. But my hope would be that within 10 years, let's say, we can have worked with a city to look at biodiversity corridors, to really take on a whole city as a case, and maybe one or two or three, and create corridors for biodiversity, corridors for life. And I think more than ever with COVID, we saw it. Everyone crave nature. We all looked for a place. It wasn't even bringing plants within our home, but to go and reconnect to nature. And so my hope is that we can reconnect as many people as possible to nature.
To do these biodiversity corridors, what's needed to sort of speed the adoption of them or the momentum? What needs to be in place?
If I may say, funding, of course, public and private, but then also understanding. You see, I think this was the challenge creating Tsugi, is that you go to people and you say, hey, we're not going to plant trees. We're going to create pocket forests. We're going to create biomes. And people are, wait, what do you mean? Today it's different, right? I can come and we have an impact report. We have a book. We can show the results. But I think understanding of the power of these forests is as important as the funding. It goes hand in hand.
And in your mind, what should city planners be factoring in when they are incorporating any kind of nature-based solution? What should they be factoring in?
Biodiversity. It's a key aspect that is overlooked. Whatever we do in life, we need our pollinators and we need the web of life. Depends also on country. For example, with the experience that we had in London, one council, it was a striking experience, is that imagine cities today, they buy, if I may say, full-grown expensive trees. These are trees that are just literally put into concrete, right, on a very small space. And they're standing there alone. In a few years, with a bit of heat, those trees do not last. Here's the thing. With what we do with Tsugi Pocket Forest, it is an essential infrastructure. It's low cost and it's long-term resilience. But see, nature is complex. And without the complexity, there is no resilience. And I think that's just the simplicity of it. Like, if we want to make resilient cities, then let's think on how we adopt nature within it.
If there were two or three groups, you're like, gosh, you know, this could make such an impact if these folks were fully online to knowing the impact. Who would be really, really beneficial to understand this even more?
For sure, city officials. And again, a city is defined in many ways. If you look at cities in South Africa or cities in, you know, again, in the US or like you go to New York or San Francisco, it's all very layered. But in the end, what it takes is one person that says, let's do this, with a vision and with an ability to fund things. It can literally be anyone. It's just somebody that believes in this transformation. And so I have to say, we did have fantastic city here in the US reach out to us and ask us to look at the master plan. And that is, for me, visionary. It's like also taking a leap of faith of doing it differently, because I understand with real estate, when you have a client, they need to also deliver a finished product. And what we do at Sugi is we build from the ground up. We plant saplings that are, what, 40, 60 centimeters. So they're small, and we create from the ground up. So it takes time. But if you want to do things resilient, it takes time. 2 to 3 years, what is it in the end in the scope of things? Nothing, you know?
Yeah. You'd said that, hey, it's not about just planting one tree, that we need to sort of create a biome. Are there other perception shifts that, or maybe misunderstandings that people might have about creating nature-based solutions that people just, they're not in it enough and they just maybe don't fully understand?
When we started, people were like, why? Okay, and today you can say, now there's all these pocket forests around the world. We were out there in London measuring the temperature on one of the hottest days. There was 17 degrees Celsius difference on the street versus next to the pocket forest. What more can we do? And that is a conversation that happens often. It's like, our cities are getting hotter. And people would like be tempted to plant species that come from hotter regions. But why? Why not plant native and plant dense? We that bring back the small mammals that were once here. And even when you plant dense and some trees do not survive, it doesn't matter because you still will have a dense ecosystem and it will support one another. See, again, if one tree will fail, the other will support it. It becomes resilient.
Is there a way that you have maybe changed how you approach building these pocket forests now than maybe when you started in 2020? Is there something that, hey, didn't occur to you at the beginning, but now you're like, oh, this is an integral part of this process. We should always consider X or Y or do X or Y.
The method is the method. It's a proven Japanese method of planting. So we really go by this method. And the forest makers now, let me tell you, like we've got a community of 26 forest makers around the world. And they're all trained with us and they really adopt the method in an authentic way. And see, that's another thing, that authenticity is so important. And so in that regard, nothing has changed. But what has changed is that all of a sudden we understand what we're doing, because, you know, 3 years have gone by, some of the forest are completely wild and self-sustaining. And that is when you can start to see hope. I think it was so important with Sugi to bring that hope in people's life and that joy and the laughter when we plant.
Was there a moment in any startup, I'm sure you've had this, but you sort of hit a wall and you're sort of not sure how you're going to get through it. You get through that, but there's a moment where you aren't sure. There's a turning point. What was that like for you?
I think one of the challenging parts for me personally at the beginning is that you come with an idea that you're going to focus 2019, 2020 on biodiversity, ecosystem restoration, and reconnecting people to nature. And the challenging part for me was that so many people around me were like, why? And why are you not talking about climate change or about carbon or doing a footprint calculation? And I think that's a challenge when you're in a startup, is that there's so many thoughts and so many ideas, and how do you stick to one vision and try and see if it works or not, but at least try. I think it's really challenging.
Once you got the funding and you were able to sort of maybe operate in a way that a startup can't without, did you have to change the way you work in order to kind of scale and to kind of like add more projects? Was that an adjustment?
So for us, it was a bit of a different way, because these pocket forests are funded forest by forest. People cannot really come to us and say, oh, I want to adopt a tree. No, because we plant as a whole. And I think that was a very challenging point in the beginning, because it's like, how are you going to find the right partners that want to do this? And through my career and what I've done in the past, I was really fortunate to be able to forge these partnerships with brands. And they saw it really, let me be very clear, they were actually absolutely visionary and trusting that we were going to build biodiversity and green infrastructure. There was no conversation about how many trees and are we going to offset or not. No. If you were to choose to plant with us, you were going to do that within a city and really bringing that transformation. And through that, we've actually been able to push forward this portfolio of pocket forest. And today, it's really great, because through that proof of concept, or whatever you want to call it, cities can come to us and say, wow, okay, you've done this and this and this there. Can you do this for us now? And so internally grateful to the partners that wanted to do this with us and take that leap of faith. Yeah.
You were talking about how important it is for children to feel soil, that they need to learn to care. If I'm a parent listening to this, what are maybe two or three ways that I can sort of instill that love of nature in my kid that maybe I wouldn't think of otherwise?
Well, soil isn't dirty. we had many children that say, I can't be dirty. And we're like, this soil, it's not dirty, it's healthy soil. And I think another thing is that when I see parents do that, it's also like, take children out into nature, but let them do what they need to do. And I think that's the beauty with the planting, is that there's no rules. So they come to the field, the trees lay on the side, and imagine, you know, it's not one type of trees, 23 different species in the UK. And if we plant 200 square meters, 2,000 square feet, it's 600 trees, and we tell them, just go for it. The first moment, they're like, wait, what? Like, can we really let go? 5 minutes later, it's like the trees are flying around, meaning like they're running around with the trees, they're planting, and it's that just trust. The child actually understands nature much better than we do, you know?
Is there a piece of advice that you've always been grateful for?
We talked about hitting walls before, right? And I was really fortunate to meet Satish Kumar last year in November. And at that point, I felt very overwhelmed. The problem is so big, right? And what am I going to do by planting these couple of pocket forests? Does that really mean in the scope of things? And Satish said to me at that point, he said, do not think about that. You can only do your best. And you could only focus on what you do. And what you do, do it with your whole heart and do it with your integrity and with love. The rest doesn't matter.
That was Elise Van Middelen. Thanks so much to her, and thanks so much to you for listening. Find a transcript of this episode, as well as transcripts from my colleague's podcast, Radio Davos, at wef.ch/podcasts. This episode of Meet the Leader was produced and presented by me, with Jerry Johansson and Taz Kelleher as editor, and Gareth Nolan driving studio production. That's it for now. I'm Linda Lucina with the World Economic Forum. Have a great day.